Come one, come all, come gather around. Come hear tales both lost and found. Finally a show not about true crime. It's David and Michael's story time.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the very special 99th episode of Storytime!
It's our last double digit.
Yeah. After this, we triple digits only, baby.
We got to tick on digits. Over. Yeah, we did it. We made it. Now, almost. We're almost there.
This being the 99th episode, nothing's changing. This is just a regular happy stance, fun times pod day with us two, with your two favorite hostess, Michael Santel.
And David Miller.
But for the next one, we have a fun thing, but we'll tease that at the very end.
Yeah, David, we'll talk about that later.
David, I talked last time. I told you about that man killing things, 7-1. What are you teaching us today?
Today, you said it's like a normal story, and that's true. However, this is kind of special because this is actually my favorite novel, like my actually favorite book. But today I'm going to be going over Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, which is a classic science fiction novel written, in the 50s or 60s, I want to say. I think it might even be the 50s.
Now, this was the prequel to Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, correct?
Yes,
they're directly connected.
That is a direct sequel.
So the Bush family, the Prescott Bush gets talked about in this. There's some 9/11 conspiracies we're going to go over today. I'm very excited for those things.
All right. So this is a classic sci-fi book, it's kind of funny because I went through it yesterday and did all of my notes. I spent like 2 hours putting it all together, and then I realized I didn't check with you to see if you knew the story already.
So I actually
thought about it and I was like, I bet he hasn't read it. And then I texted you and
I have absolutely not read it.
Yeah.
I know. I feel like this popped. It's the same thing like the fairy tale last week, right? I know that they burned books, but that's all I know. And I don't know the structure.
If you haven't read Fahrenheit 451, you at least kind of probably know somewhere in your mind, it's about censorship, I think. Great.
But how does the world work if there's no books? Like, are there dictionaries? Are there, like, pamphlets? Man. How do the Jehovah Witnesses get more people to the Watchtower subscription?
It's a very interesting world that he kind of sets up. And it's not, like, crazy sci-fi in that, like, it's some world where everything is lasers and flying cars and spaceships and stuff. But, like, it's really actually kind of weird because keep in mind that he wrote it in the 50s. The depiction that he has in the books kind of is like 90s to early 2000s for the most part. Like, it's a really weirdly accurate prediction of a lot of elements of America.
Does the main character listen to all of his music that he got from Napster on his small MP3 player? Is that from the 2000s?
He doesn't really listen to music, actually, because I don't really think a lot of people do. And we'll kind of get into it, but, like, culture is weird in this book. I'll leave it at that, but we'll get into it, yeah.
Is this a world where art is frowned upon?
That depends, and we'll get into that. Like, I can't say yes completely, but
so
I will
say...
So,
in my mind, I'm picturing Equilibrium. Is this like Equilibrium? Is there kung fu fighting?
I haven't seen Equilibrium.
I knew
you were going to be mad. I knew you were going to be mad. So many people have told me, oh, it's a great action movie, you would love it. So, I haven't seen it. Okay.
It's a wonderful knockoff of The Matrix.
Yeah, there you go.
That isn't The Matrix, but boy, did Christian Bale want to be in The Matrix so badly. So badly.
Did you know that an alternate casting that almost happened for The Matrix was Will Smith as Neo and Val Kilmer as Morpheus?
I'm going to let you know that I would love to travel to an alternate Earth and
I would
see
love
that
to
movie.
See it, but I'm glad we got The Matrix we did. Does that make sense?
Oh, for sure. But I hate to say it, I'm a Val Kilmer fangirl.
I love Val Kilmer. Don't get me wrong.
Listen, I've been told he is garbage to work for, and he's very difficult, but boy, do I love him.
Yeah, I'm your Huckleberry, man.
Listen, we're way off in the weeds right now, so we got to get to the story. Okay. But listen, this is not the right place to talk about this. Did you know that there's like a 3-hour version of Batman Forever that's super dark?
No.
There's a director's cut of Batman Forever that's not the version that we got, that's never seen the light of day, and boy, do I want to see that brooding Val Kilmer. I want it so badly, David. I want it. You got to make it. HBO Max, make that a thing. Make that a thing, HBO Max.
All right, so let's...
So how do we start? Once upon a time in a dystopian future.
Well, hold on. Before we begin... I'm going to just preface this with, I have read this novel many times, but I don't have it with me here in current quarantine.
It's in my garage, and I refuse to find it.
But what I do have is the authorized adaptation in graphic novel form, so it's very me, by Tim Hamilton. And this is a really, like, kind of a... my perfect example of an adaptation of a novel to a comic book, because it is like one-to-one. Like I was telling you earlier, the dialogue in this is like straight from the book. I'm pretty sure all the major beats and events and even details mostly happen. Now, obviously you're not going to get the same like total prose that Ray Bradbury has, which is amazing. So like, I absolutely recommend going and reading the novel version of this, but this is a really solid version of it. And it was easy for me to go through relatively quickly to put it all together last night.
Now, you said his name is Tim Dillon, and he is the artist?
No, Tim Hamilton is the guy who arranged the adaptation, and I believe drew it as well, yes.
And okay, I was going to say...
And the original story is by Ray Bradbury, yeah.
Right, okay. I was going to say, like, he wouldn't rewrite it, right? Like, he would just take the words and then just draw something to
it. Yeah. Okay. And this is also, again, this is the authorized adaptation, and it even is lent a little bit of credibility because the introduction to this is written by Ray Bradbury in, like, 2008 or something.
Oh, so he gave a stamp of approval.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, go for it. This is great. So, without any further ado, before we begin... do you have any predictions? I know you know that, like, books get burned, and that's about it, so...
Okay, this is a dystopian world, so...
I didn't say that.
Okay, you didn't say that. I am projecting that. I feel like this probably was influenced by other novels of that time that have to do with censorship. So I feel like all of my predictions come in that, like, 1984 flavor. So, okay. Like... society we will recognize, but will be very different.
Okay.
If they burn books, like, I guess they're way into, like, camping. Like, they're way into outside stuff. Like, there's going to be... okay, here's some predictions. We're going to see a fun futuristic building, and we'll, like, see all the, like, fun, like, in gadgets and stuff like that that we won't really, like, spend time on, but they'll be like, oh, that's the Whirly Bird. We know. Everyone knows about the Whirly Bird.
Okay.
I guess if there is censoring of materials, right, there must be some sort of... adjustment bureau. Like, there has to be some sort of...
an enforcement arm of that, right?
There has to be somebody going in and being like, we found your books, you're not allowed to have these. So, some sort of militarized police.
Essentially, the long arm of the law that would be enforcing that censorship, right?
Right.
Like you said, yeah.
And I feel like in many of these stories, the thing that wakes the person up to
the truth that is, yeah.
It is usually love. Like, they fall in love with a girl, and then they're like, I gotta help Stephanie get out of here.
Okay.
So I think there will be some sort of love interest.
Okay.
And my far out one, now it's a sci-fi world, so there's no talking animals, but there will be a talking vending machine. Like, it'll be like, your Coca-Cola is ready, sir. That's gonna happen as well. Also, they're British. Okay. I think that's gonna happen.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, first of all, they are not British. This is definitely taking place in the United States.
Yay, America!
You were pretty close to right on some of them, and there was one specifically, and I'll try to remember that you said it later, that you were, like, half right on.
Okay. Yeah. There's so many of these worlds now. Like, I feel like I've seen slivers of all of them. You've never seen Equilibrium. So I'm just going to compare this to Equilibrium the whole
time. And this story itself was probably, like, has been referenced by other things since then, right? So, like...
Animaniacs. Looney Tunes.
Of course.
Brady. Yeah.
The famous Jet Jackson did an episode that centered around this book. The Disney Channel original series from the mid or early 2000s, I want to say.
Oh, I apologize. I was not a Jet Jackson fan, so...
It's a deep cut from suburban white America, so there you go.
Okay.
All right. So let's get started. We are going to begin. We have a little montage of our main character, Guy Montag.
Guy Montag. That's the most futuristic name I've ever heard.
Yeah. Guy Montag is a fireman.
Oh, cool.
That's just his job.
Yo, people love firemen. There's no rap songs about fuck the firefighters. People love firefighters. That's great.
Well, I'm glad you say that, but here's the thing. in this world, in this future, buildings have long been fireproof.
Oh.
Firemen do not fight fires. They start them. The firemen are the Adjustment Bureau, the enforcement arm that goes and burns books.
Whoa.
So okay. Our main character is a member of the firemen. And now they work like actual firemen. They are at the station. There's a fucking pole they slide down. They wait for an alarm.
So they spend 8 hours a day working out, watching USA Today. They eat a lot of chili. And then when fire happens, or I guess when, to be fair.
When the need for a fire.
I also like the idea that you give it to the responsible people, right? Like, they should be setting the fires. They know how to fight them. This is just like another part of their like.
They literally don't fight fires. Like, and we'll get into it, but they literally, like, think it's laughable that a fireman would put out a fire.
So silly. It's so funny. I wonder what terms we have for things now that in 100 years they'll be like, oh, no, I don't think you want to see the concierge. No, I would like to see the concierge.
All right. So he finishes the shift at the firehouse. Now, the main difference here is that they don't have the whole, like, they're there for 3 days, then they're off for 4 days kind of thing. They're like, go back and forth, home to firehouse, kind of like regular work.
It makes all sense. Right. It's a little less dangerous now. You're not going to die. You know what I mean? You're not going to
yeah,
die. Every
yeah, day. Yeah, yeah. So he finishes the shift at the firehouse, takes a shower, starts walking home. On the way home, he runs into a young girl that he recognizes as, like, his new neighbor. Like, her family just moved in, like, next door or whatever.
What does the world look like? You said, are there flying cars? Does it look like the Jetsons?
No, the cars are on the road still, but they go real fast. They kind of talk about it literally in the upcoming thing. But the highways are, like, kind of the main, like, between cities is basically nothing but stretches of, like, super huge wide highway where cars fly down at, like, 200-300 miles an hour.
Did anything happen in the world of America that has made these places uninhabitable? Is there, like, a disease or anything? Was there a war?
Nothing happened to make, like, outside of cities uninhabitable. It's not uninhabitable. It's just that society is basically separated into just these huge chunks of city. There have been wars. They mentioned sort of in the background there have been 2 atomic wars by this point.
Okay, so there's no law. So there's not like flyby states. There's just drive real fast states. There's drive-by states. Okay.
Yes. And the wars, the 2 atomic wars, presumably America has won them.
Okay, but is it like Risk 2020? Is it like Risk 2099 where like you can't go to Idaho anymore? Like
no,
we have to
no,
go
no, no.
around?
There's no indication that like America has been struck with nukes or that like outside the cities are unsafe. Literally
Yay!
Just people
America
live in the
nuked other people. Good job, America. Yeah. We did it.
Okay, so he meets this girl whose name is Clarice McClellan.
Clarice. Hello, yeah. Clarice.
Yeah. And she is she says she's 17 years old. Later she reveals that she's 17 years old in a few months, so she's 16.
Okay.
Guy Montag is 30, and at this point, I'd like to let you know of the half prediction you got correct. The thing that makes people, like, you know, sort of lift the veil. In this case, you could say it's, like, love, but it's not falling in romantic love, is what I wanted to, like, there's not a romantic connection here between Clarice and Guy.
This 30-year-old doesn't Lolita this 15-year-old girl.
Correct. But she is sort of the more or less the catalyst that starts things off.
Okay.
So he meets Clarice and he's like, what are you doing out so late? Like, oh, you're my neighbor. Like, what are you doing out here? Like, just walking around like as a pedestrian? That's fucking weird. No one does that. Like, you know? And she's
kids
like,
do
oh.
that. That's the thing kids do. Kids she's go like, walk around.
Well, that's the thing. This is a whole different time. So being a pedestrian is not a normal thing. Like, yeah. She's like, oh, well, I'm 17 and I'm crazy. Like, that's what my uncle says. He says, being crazy comes with being 17. So when people ask, say that you're 17 and you're crazy, right? You know? And she's like, I like to walk around. I like to smell stuff. I like to look at things. I like to just think. And he's like, what the fuck? That's weird. Yeah, you're weird.
That's a little out of the peer view. I'm assuming in this future world, they, you know, play video games or some shit, right?
We'll see what they do. What a lot of people do that sort of fills their mind and time. Yeah.
It's probably Fortnite.
So she starts to ask him kind of a lot of questions she's like, hey, can I walk home with you as you're walking? He's like, yeah, whatever. So she starts asking him questions of like, hey, how long have you been a fireman? He's like, oh, like 10 years. She's like, do you read any of the books that you burn? And he's like, what the fuck? No, that would be illegal, right? And she asks him, is it true that firemen used to put out fires? And he's like, oh, no. Houses have always been built fireproof. Like, that's not a thing.
So whatever the change in the world is, he was not... Within his lifetime. Right, within the last 30 years, no firefighters have put out fires.
I believe so, yeah. Something like that. Yeah. So he's, like, super puzzled by her. She, like, mentions the moon, and he realizes that, like, he hasn't looked up at the moon in, like, years.
Sort of like our cell phone bubble technology now. We don't look up. We're too busy on FaceTime.
So they get to, like, their homes, and she, like, kind of starts – she's like, all right, thanks for the walk or whatever, and she goes to her house. And she – the last thing she says before she goes inside is, quick question, are you happy? And he's like, What does that even mean? Like, what do you mean? What? Of course I am. You know? And then as he, like, kind of goes off and starts walking home, he starts really, like, the wheels start turning, and he realizes, maybe I'm not. Like, actually, I don't think I am. You know? Like, he thought he was.
Everybody so he gets home. At home right now, just take a moment. Are you happy? Are you happy with what's going on? Listen, no, COVID sucks. We're not bringing up that. I'm just saying, are you happy? That's a good question to ask yourself.
What a great mental state to put our audience in as we continue forward.
Listen, they're happy with this. I'm happy with this episode. I just want to know, they should ask themselves, are they happy right now?
Great. Okay. So he gets home, and as he comes in, kind of his mind sort of churning on, like, this, wow, that girl was super weird. Why is she, like, so weird and fascinating to me? Like, all these different things.
She's on the edge of 17, David. He doesn't know how to handle these youths. Oh, okay.
He gets home, and he finds his wife, Mildred, passed out in bed, and there is an open, empty pill bottle on the floor next to her.
Oh, no. Fentanyl? Mm-hmm. What is it, David?
Happy pills, basically. So he flips out and essentially calls 911 or the equivalent, and has to sit there and watch as two dudes, technicians with, like, machine briefcases, come in, and they put a fucking camera, you know, like, down her throat, and they basically pump her stomach, but it's, like, sci-fi future, so then not only do they pump her stomach, but they pump out and replace her blood.
Ooh,
because they're cool. they're like, what's the point of clearing the stomach if you don't clear the blood? The shit's all in the blood, so we gotta get the blood. Like,
yo, you know. That I like the idea of these medical briefcases, though, doing all the work.
And it is very clear while they do this that, like, they're just going through the motions. This is so run-of-the-mill. They see this shit all the time. They do
people
this a
OD,
lot.
People OD so often that they're like, hi, hello, let
literally,
us in.
Literally, like, they finish, and they're like, okay, great, that'll be $50. And he's like, is she going to be okay? And they're like, oh, yeah, we got all the shit. It's in our briefcase right here. And as they're walking out the door, they're like, oh, another call. Someone else just jumped off the lid of a bottle. Gotta go. Like, and they, like, have another call to go pump someone's stomach.
Jumped off the lid.
That's how they say
bottle.
It. Yeah. Someone just jumped off the lid of a bottle.
Did she purposely take too much? Like, are people trying to kill themselves, or is it just an accident and the drugs are too powerful?
It doesn't necessarily say. I'm gonna say it was not intentional. Okay. So we will kind of get to that, though, because in the morning he wakes up, he comes down, and she's sitting up at the, you know, at the table or whatever on the couch. And she's like, oh, you know, good morning. And he's like, hey, I want to talk to you. Like, last night you took all your pills. And she's like, oh, no. I wouldn't do something like that. That's silly. And he's like, the bottle is empty. And she's like, whatever. And she already has moved on. She's talking about the programs. So they have these in their living room. They call them parlor walls. Essentially, an entire wall, one of the entire walls of the room is a screen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these programs come on, and they're like soap operas. They kind of don't really, they're not really about anything, but she's super excited because she has in her hands the script for tonight's program. It's a new thing they're doing where at a certain point, all of the characters will, like, say their lines and then stop and turn essentially, like, to the viewer in the room and wait for you to say your one line, which is, like, a line that is like, yes, absolutely. And then the program will continue forward with whatever it's doing.
It's interactive TV, and it's
but it's also mindless,
right? And they well, I was gonna say they talked about soap operas, which are very clearly, you know, a different term. But reality TV has basically become, you know,
I wasn't
soap
saying
operas.
Soap operas are mindless, but, like, that's the kind of the vibe of what these programs are very sort of like soap operas about nothing, like, you know what I mean?
Right, love triangles and people getting together and, you know, scheming and
like
stuff
not
like
even
that.
Anything complicated like that. It's literally just characters, like, having conversations, but the she, at least Mildred, as we see, is like so, like, it's literally the, she's not even like actually listening to what Guy is saying to her. She's just sort of like brushing it off and moving on to talking about the program.
I also don't want to go away from TV walls real quick. We're not there yet in like, because like,
see,
we're not
but like, it's
TV
one of those
walls.
Things where like he did predict it because TVs just got bigger and bigger and flatter and flatter, and we dedicate now basically an entire wall of your living room to your TV. Anyway,
oh, I was
right?
I was just about to say, I feel like we are like whenever the next level of smart houses are going to happen, they'll be like, oh, do you want the Sony 200 inch? And you're like, yeah, I want the Sony 200 inch because like why not just put it installed?
And she even talks to him about like, can we get another wall? Can we get like a second wall put in and a third? Like. And I think even in the novel, she talks about how, like, some family has three walls. And it's like, that's insane. But, like,
ooh, gotta keep up with the Joneses. Gotta get those TV walls all over the place.
Yeah. So he's like, all right, I gotta go to work. So he leaves. And on his way to work, he runs into Clarice again. And it's raining.
Hello, Clarice.
She's standing out in the rain. And he's like, what are you doing? She's like, oh, I have a dandelion. This is, I think, the last dandelion of the season. That's cool, right? And he's like,
what the fuck is a dandelion?
Like, why are you out here in the rain? Like, you are crazy. Like, you know?
He doesn't give two shits about the world. He doesn't care about nature or anything. He just lives in his little bubble.
Yeah. She, you know, she's doing that thing of like, oh, sometimes I like to stand out in the rain and just tilt my head back and, like, drink it in. And he's like, that's the weirdest fucking thing I've ever heard.
First off, 17-year-olds are weird in general. Like, this is all par for the course.
To a 30-year-old, you're going to be like, oh, you fucking kid.
Yeah, what are you doing?
She does mention to him how it's odd that he's a fireman. Because it doesn't seem fitting for him. Like, as she's kind of gotten to know him a tiny bit, he doesn't seem like the type that would, like, why did you choose to be a fireman? Like, that seems kind of like a weird job for you. And at that point, he's like, I gotta go, bye. And, like, kind of, like, dips out. Like, he doesn't want to deal with that thought.
Ooh, why is he a firefighter? Why did he make that life choice?
I mean, we won't find out. I don't know. He doesn't know. But it's the first time that it's kind of been pointed out to him. And he probably, on some level, agrees that, like, it is weird. Why... It isn't. I'm not really that type, you know?
Mm.
Or at least he might be feeling like he might not be. So he gets to the station, and as he walks in, he walks by what is called the Hound. It's an actual mechanical, like, dog, like, big, mechanical, mean-looking, like, dog with, like, syringes and shit in its mouth. And it's, like, kind of in its little pen, in its cage. And as he walks by, it, like, growls at him and kind of, like, lurches at him a little bit, and he's like, whoa, he like gets freaked out, and he goes up the pole, which is another sci-fi thing. He grabs the pole and it like pulls him up.
Yeah. Reversible pole technology. I've been waiting for it every day. Do the robot dogs just like, are they just like programmed that way, or
that's the thing is he comes
or
up
did
and
he
like,
trigger it
he comes up and he's like, look, that thing doesn't like me. And like the captain is like, what, the Hound? That's impossible. It can't like or not like. It's a robot. Like, it's programmed to do stuff. And it has all of our profiles, so, like, it shouldn't be jumping out at you. It knows who you are. And he's like, yeah, well, that's, like, the third time it's done it to me. So, like, I don't know what to tell you. You know?
Ooh, syringe dog also sounds like a...
Syringe
dog? We should make syringe dogs. It sounds like a good way to get kids to take vitamins and stuff like that.
Syringe dog is my punk metal band.
Oh, yeah.
So, syringe dog is essentially, like a tracker, like... fugitive hunter, essentially.
Yeah. Right? Hunter killer.
Yeah. So he complains about it, but they're like, whatever. A few days go by, like a week goes by. So we kind of like see a sort of montage. Every day, Clarice ends up like being outside as he walks to work. So she kind of walks with him to like the corner or whatever, and then they sort of split. And then I have to read post-it number one. I'm back to post-its in the book.
I love post-its.
Oh, so this is Clarice. So this is me just kind of pointing out another little prediction that Ray Bradbury kind of did. And while this example might not be as extreme as what kind of currently happens in the world, I think you'll be able to see the parallel. Guy asks her, hey, why aren't you in school? This is like at some day during the week. Hey, why aren't you in school? Every day I just see you wandering around. And she says, oh, they don't miss me. I'm antisocial, they say. I don't mix. I'm afraid of children my own age. They kill each other. Six of my friends have been shot in the last year alone. So
why are they shooting kids?
Why are you not in school? Oh, there are like a billion school shootings is her answer.
Ooh.
Right?
Interesting.
So, you know, just saying.
Well, obviously there is a moral decay in the society that is not being addressed. Mm. And now we see multiple instances of it and how it is affecting the youth of that culture.
Yeah. So after like a week or so, some time passes of like this sort of pattern of like them walking together and then walking together. And he really, they start getting to know each other. But then she stops showing up as he walks to work. She's just not there anymore. And he doesn't really like kind of process that that's what's missing or that's what's off. Like as he continues his walk to work, but he like starts getting really unsettled or like something is up or something is missing. Why do I feel weird that, and then eventually he realizes, oh, cause I haven't seen Clarice in a while. Like that's really fucking strange.
What occupies his mind?
I think that there's a general, normal... like the sort of the theme in this book, there's a general sense of sort of blankness to people. They don't think critically about anything is kind of the point.
Okay.
And so he gets to the firehouse, like after having been off because Clarice is no longer there. And he sort of, while they're playing cards, he offhandedly muses to everyone, hey, do you guys like did back in the old days, did firemen fight fires instead of starting them? And all the guys are like, ah, that's crazy. That's rich. That's insane. Blah, 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 blah. And one of the guys pulls like the sort of fireman's manual or like pamphlet, I will say, because it's not a book, but like
it's not a book. They burned the book. So what is it?
It's a little pamphlet that he pulls out and he throws it on and he's like, look at the rules. And I have the rules here to read. Established.
If there's pamphlets, then Jehovah's Witnesses are probably still in this world, right? They can still like have their Watchtower pamphlets.
I'm not sure. So okay. here's what they show him to be proof of like, no. Firemen have always set fires. Established 1790 to burn English-influenced books in the colonies. First fireman, Benjamin Franklin. Rule 1, answer the alarm swiftly. Rule 2, start the fire swiftly. Rule 3, burn everything. Rule 4, report back to the firehouse immediately. Rule 5, stand by for other alarms.
David, that's not what Benjamin Franklin did. I know that. There's no way that's a thing. There's no way that's how this country was founded.
I don't know. At least that's what the powers that be says, right?
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
So at that moment, an alarm sounds. And so everyone drops what they're doing and they go and they get ready and they fly down and they get in their truck and they go.
Is it like a beep beep alarm or is it a robot voice?
It's like a clang. Alert. It specifically says clang, clang, clang. So it's probably just like one of those metal like bell sort of alarms.
Is there any chance there's a chimpanzee with a cup and it's and the chimp gets a banana whenever there's a fire?
Let's say sure, but no.
Okay. It's a robot chimpanzee, David. Yeah, robot chimpanzee. Yeah.
So they get to this house and they bust down the door and there's an I'm actually going to put this book down because I have it all over here. So they get to this house, they bust in and there's an old woman standing in the hall and she's like quoting something. Clearly, she's like kind of babbling, at least to them. They don't really get it, but she's quoting. What she's actually quoting is purportedly supposed to have been what Hugh Latimer said to Nicholas Rigby in England.
Nicholas Rigby sits at a what? Is it that guy? Is it the guy from the Beatles song?
No, because that's Eleanor Rigby.
Oh, okay. This is obviously his brother or something like that.
So Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Rigby were quote-unquote heretics who were burned at the stake in Oxford, England in like the 1500s. And supposedly, Hugh Latimer said something to Nicholas Rigby.
What did he say?
He said, play the man, Master Ridley. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out. And then they were burnt at the stake.
Are they the candle? They were the candle that would never be put out?
Yeah, they're essentially they're being burned as heretics, but they know in their faith that they're doing the right thing. So their candle will burn forever in the kingdom of heaven, essentially, is what they're saying.
Are the bad people of the world God fearing people? Is that like looked down upon by this modern technological society?
They don't really discuss religion at all in this book.
Okay. Interesting.
Except for the fact that, well, they don't really, but we'll sort of deal with... A Bible shows up at some point.
That shit's got to get burned real fast.
So she's quoting this, and Guy immediately is like, what the fuck is she doing here? Usually when we get to somewhere where there's an alarm, the cops have already shown up and have like arrested the person or whatever, and we just show up to burn the place. What is she doing here? So then they don't
have to see the people that they're displacing, right? Usually, right. That's usually taken care of,
right? So they find a bunch of books and start piling them all together, And Guy, kind of like one falls into his hands, and he kind of is like surprised for a second, and sort of without thinking, and sort of quickly, he stashes it in his coat.
What was the book?
I can't remember. I can look it up in a second, but it might be Gulliver's Travels.
Ooh, okay. The Jack Black version, correct?
Yes, it's the DVD of Gulliver's Travels. so then they start pouring kerosene onto the books. Their general tactic is to douse the place in kerosene.
They
and then
just don't
light it up.
Even have futuristic fire. They just use regular old kerosene to light
flame
this place up.
Flamethrowers exist, but the general procedure is to just douse everything in kerosene and burn it up. In the novel, I think it actually describes they axe the walls to tear off the fireproofing cover before they set the place on fire.
Okay.
But the graphic novel doesn't really go into that. But
and anyway, you instantly just forfeit your whole everything.
Having books is absolutely illegal.
Okay.
Okay. So they start dousing everything in kerosene, and like the woman is guy's like, well, guys, we can't leave her in here. And all the other firemen are like, she doesn't want to go. She's like refusing to leave. And so guy's like, please come with me. And she goes, no, thank you anyway. I'd like to stay here. And so he like kind of walks out, and then the chief, whose name is Beatty, Chief Beatty, he goes to light the kerosene. He like takes out his lighter and he kind of steps forward to light it. But before he does, the old woman pulls a match out, strikes it, and lights herself and all the books on fire. Ooh. And so like in the doorway, guy sees this like woman burning amongst all of her books and choosing to, right?
That imagery is so visceral, and it reminds me of the protests of monks in China and stuff like that. I wonder if that imagery was in the social zeitgeist yet, because that also feels like a prediction. Like that's a very big statement.
I think that this might have, I don't remember when that happened. That was during the Vietnam War, wasn't it? So I believe this would have been written before that happened.
Oof. Okay. So she has chosen to go out with her books. I'm going out the way I came into this world. On fire.
And you say
books.
The imagery is like, really sticks out. I do remember in the novel, it is a very well written bit of imagery. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that sort of image does stick with Guy. He's like, holy shit, we just burned a woman essentially with all of her books.
You don't need to feel bad, Guy. I'm Chief Beatty. She did that to herself. You don't need to worry about that.
And they're all kind of like, man, she was crazy, right? And he's kind of like, I don't know if she was, you know? And on the way back, Guy is like, man, what was she saying? Like, when we came in there, like, what was that thing she was saying, right? The whole heretic quote. And Captain Beatty is like, oh, she was quoting Hugh Latimer to Nicholas Rigby. You just picked this stuff. Right. So he's like, as a fire captain, you kind of have to know this stuff. So we get a glimpse at that. Beatty might be well read. Like he might know a lot more than most people do about this shit.
It instantly reminds me of not directly, but that scene in 1984 when he has to go to the office. And the guy turns off the TV screen. He's like, what? Yeah. You can turn those off? He's like, us senior members have privileges. So then you've already intrigued me with this mystery. I wonder when he knew stuff, and was it before the way that the world is now? Because obviously firefighters for the last 30 years, right? This has been the world of Guy.
Guy has been a firefighter for 10 years, but for anyone's recent memory.
Right. Like, within Guy's lifetime though, right? Like this is the way it's always been. Yeah. So I wonder how old Beatty is with his little beady eyes.
He is older than Guy. That is for sure. Especially because he's the chief, right? Guy gets home and he asks Mildred if he's seen Clarice around. Like, hey, you know that neighbor girl? Like, have you seen her around? I haven't seen her around lately. And she's like, oh,
that 16-year-old going on 17. I need to take care of her.
Mildred kind of like absentmindedly is like, oh, I think the family like moved off somewhere. I'm pretty sure the girl died, like hit by a car or something, like 4 days ago. And then totally just, like, as though she forgets she even was talking about it, moves on. And, like, is talking about the programs, right? And Guy is like, the fuck? Like, what? And in the morning, he wakes up and he's, like, sick. He, like, feels like he has a fever. He can't get up. He doesn't want to go into work. And again, Mildred, who he sometimes calls Millie. So if I say Millie, that's why, is like barely present. She's like there, she's watching the programs in the living room. And Guy's like, hey, can you like turn that off? Cause I have a huge headache. And she's like, no.
Yeah, they have future technology, but no one thought of Bluetooth headphones yet. So like, that's not there. Is this does he have to work? Is money a thing? Do they have rent?
Yes.
Or do okay?
Yes.
Does Millie have a job?
When she asks, she does not have a job. When she asks Guy about getting another wall, he's like, "Whoa, that's like a third year salary for me." Like,
oh,
you know.
Okay.
So like
okay.
That would be an expensive thing. And she even is like, "What? You don't care about me?" Like it's one of those fucking discussions.
okay. One of those discussions. All right, that's for your therapist, David. You don't have to talk about that here.
No,
that's
you don't understand. This podcast is my therapy.
Oh, well, okay.
So Guy tries to talk to Millie about like what happened last night. He's like, Millie, like we burned a woman with her books. Like we set her on fire, or essentially, like, she set herself on fire, but, like,
and she's
Jesus
just,
Christ.
And she's just going, California girls, we
basically,
are in Plaza. Okay, yeah,
basically,
she's out.
Like, the most that she responds to what he's talking about is like, ah, well, she shouldn't have books. She must have been super simple. What a dummy. Like, and then goes back to, like, the programs are on. Quiet. Like, I need to talk to my family. She keeps talking about the program, the characters in the show as the family.
Oh, and they don't even have DVRs in this weird world. Ray
She's
Bradbury,
gotta
you really
it.
Should.
She's gotta watch it.
Yeah, okay. She's gotta watch your programs now.
Look, Ray Bradbury couldn't predict everything, but at least
he got
big TVs, fast cars, and school shootings right. So, like, you know,
that's a beautiful trifecta. That's a beautiful trifecta.
So Captain Beatty then shows up at the house because Guy never came into work today. Right? He's sick. And
do they have cell phones? Could he call
them
on the tel?
Millie asked her to call Captain Beatty, and she just fucking didn't. Yeah,
Millie, you are not holding your weight in this relationship.
So then I have another post-it. I tell myself, let me find it. There it is. Okay. So the Guy and Beatty start kind of having a conversation because Beatty is like, oh, I just thought I'd come by to see how sick my guy was, you know, like, how's he doing? All that kind of thing. And he says, so this is going to be kind of like a whole long bit, but it's going to be basically Beatty giving us his worldview on why firemen came into being the way they are.
Okay. Yeah. And also, this is from what little I understand, a learned man. So
yeah,
I wonder if he'll put any of his learning, his school teaching in this conversation.
So what he says is every fireman sooner or later hits this in reference to like what Guy is going through because he saw this woman burned and now is like feeling sick. He doesn't know what's wrong. Every fireman sooner or later hits this. They only need understanding to know how the wheels run. When did it all start, you ask, this job of ours? I'd say it really got started around the Civil War. We didn't get along well until photography came into its own. Then motion pictures, radio, television. Once books appealed to few people here, there, everywhere, they could afford to be different. The world was roomy. But then the world got full of eyes and elbows and mouths, quadruple population, films and radios, magazines, books leveled down to a sort of paste pudding norm. Picture it, 19th century man with his horses, dogs, cats, slow motion. Then in the 20th century, speed up your camera, condensations, digests, everything boils down to the snap ending, classic cut to fill a 2-minute book column. Politics, one column, two sentences. More sports for everyone. Group spirit, fun, and you don't have to think, huh? Organize and super organize, super super sports. The mind drinks less. Highways full of crowds going somewhere, nowhere. The gasoline refugee. Now, let's take up the minorities in our civilization. Don't step on the toes of the dog lovers, the cat lovers, the doctors, Mormons, Swedes, Brooklynites, people from Mexico. The bigger your market, the less you handle controversy. Remember that. Authors, full of evil thoughts, lock up your typewriters. They did. Magazines became a nice blend of vanilla tapioca. Books, so the damn snobbish critic said, were dishwater. No wonder books stopped selling. The public, knowing what it wanted, let the comic books survive. And the three-dimensional sex magazines, of course. There you have it, Montag. It didn't come from the government down. There was no dictum, no declaration. Technology, mass exploitation, and minority pressure carried the trick. Today, thanks to them, you can stay happy all the time. And Guy says, yes, but what about the fireman then? And he says, ah, surely you remember the boy in your own school class who was exceptionally bright, did most of the reciting and answering while the others sat hating him? Wasn't it this bright boy that you selected for beatings and tortures after hours? Of course it was. Not everyone born free and equal, as the Constitution says, but everyone made equal. Each man the image of every other. Then all are happy. So, a book is a loaded gun in the house next door. Burn it. Take the shot from the weapon. Who knows who might be the target of the well-read man? Me? I won't stomach them for a minute. What do we want in this country above all? People want to be happy, isn't that right? That's all we live for, isn't it? For pleasure? For titillation? And then the guy says, yes. He mentions the girl next door, and Beatty is like, oh, Clarice McClellan? We've had a record on her family. We've watched them carefully. Heredity and environment are funny things. You can't rid yourselves of all the odd ducks in just a few years. The girl? She was a time bomb. She didn't want to know how a thing was done, but why. You ask why to a lot of things, and you wind up very happy indeed. The poor girl's better off dead. Remember, Montag, we are the happiness boys. We stand against the small tide of those who want to make everyone unhappy with conflicting theory and thought. One last thing. At least once in his career, every fireman gets an itch. What do the books say? Well, Montag, take my word for it. I've had to read a few in my time to know what I was about, and the books say nothing. And Guy asks, well, then what if a fireman accidentally, not really intending anything, takes a book home with him? Right? Because Guy did that. And Beatty says, a natural error. We let the fireman keep the book for 24 hours. If he hasn't burned it by then, we simply come burn it for him. And then Beatty leaves. That's where I'll stop.
So much.
I had to read all of that because I love Beatty as a character. He's so fucking interesting.
Well, already there are parallels to today that no one is reading long form things and that all of those things, the uber emphasis on happiness, which is not actual happiness. It is all of the, you know, vapid things that we want. Right. So it's your drugs and your pornography, but there's no substance to any of this stuff. Removing a loaded gun from next door really brings the imagery of Minority Report, right? Yeah. Like we have to snuff out the weeds even before they pop up.
But also considering that the loaded gun is a reference to the learned man, right? His exact quote was like, "How dangerous is the learned man?" Right
now,
and
David,
and to who?
In Beatty's definition, though, the Mormons are still there. I got my answer. They still have the Book of Mormon. Yes, yes. It's distilled down to a fucking one paragraph or whatever, but the Mormons are still there.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't – our character is not going to believe this because basically what Beatty is saying is, listen, I've seen the books. You don't need to see them. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
Right?
But also at that last part too, it's fairly clear that Beatty is hinting like, hey, I know you took a book last night. You know,
everyone and goes through. You have 24 hours or we're going to come here and burn it for you.
Yeah, exactly. So Beatty leaves. Guy gets up. Stands on a chair, opens a vent in the ceiling, and a bunch of books fall out.
Guy's been having lots of books.
Yes, and he's been keeping them, but he hasn't been reading them. He doesn't know why he's felt so like he needed to do this. Millie immediately.
David, do you have a vent in your house where you can hide things? I feel like I need to have a vent in my house. I have vents, but I've never hid anything in them.
I bet if I really wanted to, I could. Yes, I think I have one.
I think we got to start getting vents, hiding things in vents again. I feel like that's a good idea.
All right. So Millie immediately grabs one and runs over to like the furnace in the kitchen and tries to burn it. And Guy's like, no. Like, we're in this together now kind of thing. And he's like, I have to know what this is about. Like,
these are futuristic houses, but there's still furnaces in the houses.
It's it's like a little drawer in the wall that she opens up that she can throw something in to burn it.
Oh, okay. That's pretty cool.
So that's pretty future. That's pretty future to me. So Guy has to know what it's about and starts just reading them out loud. Millie does not understand it and does not like it. She's like, I don't understand what any of this means. This is all gibberish. This is stupid.
He's like,
what
no,
are you
no,
doing?
It's not gibberish. I would eat it in the house. I would eat it with a mouse. I would eat it. It's just Dr. Seuss books.
So while he's reading, suddenly there seems to be like sniffing outside the door. And Millie's like, oh, it's some dumb dog. And Guy is like, shut the fuck up.
It's he a robot dog. It's a taser. It's a taser dog.
Yes, it is the hound. And they're quiet for a second and then it goes away. And then they continue. Millie freaks out for a bit and says, books aren't people. They aren't real. The family is people. That's real.
Like, this isn't real. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything you're showing to me isn't real. I want to be with my friends. The Real Housewives of New Jersey. They get me. They understand me.
So while he's reading these books, he's like, man, I straight up don't understand. Like, I can't comprehend what it is I'm reading.
Why would he eat it in a box? Why would he eat it with a box?
That's the thing, is like, he's never in his life been taught reading comprehension, right? Like, that's one of those things we kind of take for granted, but like, he doesn't know how to do that. So he thinks to himself.
He can, obviously, people know how to read because there is information that is conveyed via print
text,
of like,
yeah.
Right. But I would assume that because everything you're reading is either factual or a pamphlet or telling you something, mm-hmm. he doesn't have the ability to, like,
think critically about
with the text. Yeah. So it's just like it's an overflow of information.
Yeah. So it's – the way it describes it in the book is it's just a bunch of sand going through the sieve as he's reading it, and he just can't keep any of it really in his mind. So he's thinking about, like, well, who can I get to teach me how to do this? I don't know how to do this. And he remembers a man that he met about a year ago on a bench in the park whose name was Faber. And on that day, it kind of flashes his back, but on that day, he noticed the man definitely had a book in his coat.
Ooh.
And didn't turn him in. And they kind of just sat there on the bench, sort of in silence and sort of like chatting a little bit. And it was clear to both like what the situation was of like, Guy could turn him in at any time, and Faber was kind of at his mercy, and Guy didn't do it. So then Faber gives him his card and is like, I guess if you ever change your mind about fucking punishing me, like, here's my info, and just gives it to him and leaves.
Right, but like, the way the society is, if they want to find you, they will. Everyone seems to
be. But someone has to report you for having the books, right? Like, you have to get found out for having the books.
Right, so he knows that if anyone reports him, it's going to be this guy. So you're in for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah. So Guy is like, I guess that's my shot. So he calls Faber and is like, hey, I have a weird question. How many copies of the Bible do you think there are left in the country? And Faber's like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You know, like, is this a trace line? Like, what the fuck? Who's this? I don't know. What is the Bible? Right. Like, you know,
that's a real coded shit to say over a recorded line.
And, so Guy kind of talks a little bit, but then they hang up and Guy's like, great. I need to turn in a book to Beatty, right? Obviously. But I don't want to turn in this book. I don't know if he knows I have all these books. Maybe I could replace it. Maybe I could make a copy of this one and then turn it into him. Like, so he's trying to kind of think about it. So he takes the train to Faber's house. And while he's like on the way, he's like trying to read the Bible to memorize it. But it's like it says, the sand going through the sieve. He's like trying to just read and read and read, hoping some of it will stick. So he gets there and he tells.
He can just listen to our podcast. He doesn't need to read it. Yeah. We go over it for him. It's way easier to digest.
He gets there and he tells Faber that he didn't know who else he could come to. And Faber is like, well, I have to admit, like, you're looking at a coward. I've been sitting here in the dark in my, you know, little apartment, timid and afraid of doing the right thing and just making sure that I wasn't caught and, you know, all this stuff. And so they kind of devise a plan. That at first Faber is like joking about, and Guy is like, that's a great idea, of planting books in firemen's houses and then turning them in to like throw doubt on the entire system in general.
Yeah, that's a real big plan though. That's a real scare. There's a lot of steps in that plan that could go wrong.
So Guy is like, okay, but like the one thing that's going to throw me is that when I face my chief again, he's going to like talk circles around me and I'm gonna get all fucking caught up and confused and in my head, like, can you help me with that? And Faber's like, sure. And he takes out a little homemade like earpiece. They call them seashell radios in the book, but like essentially it's a little earpiece, so that he can listen to what's going on around him and be in Guy's ear to like help him in those times.
He's his little Jiminy Cricket. He's gonna be his conscience. He's gonna be like, no, listen to that, that's garbage
for sure. His Cyrano de Bergerac, if you will. So Guy goes home, and Mildred has a couple friends over to watch tonight's shows, which I believe
the
is called...
We call them programs, David.
Yes, I believe tonight's is called The White Clown.
And it's like
uber cartoony violence. It's like the clown is like fucking chainsawing whatever, and yeah, it's super mindless fun.
It's in chapter one.
Yeah. They like something that's been in the backdrop of the story this whole time is that the world and the United States is kind of seeming to ramp up towards another war. Mm. Like there's constantly the sound of bombers like zooming overhead. And stuff. And it's kind of all just in the background. Like, it hasn't affected anything in the story yet. But Guy kind of asks these ladies who Mildred has over, like, where are your husbands? Are you guys worried? Like, there's supposed to be a war coming, right? Like, your husbands are in the army. Like, are you guys worried? And they're like, oh, no. Like, one of them's like, oh, no, the army called Pete, like, the other day to go up. But they said he'll only be gone a week. It's just going to be a quick war. And, like, you know, like, shit. Like, and they're like, they don't give a fuck that their husbands are wherever they are, you know?
Right. They're taking happy pills and watching programs. They don't care. What does it matter? Mm-hmm. They'll be home when they're home.
So Guy pulls out a book of poetry, and Faber in his ear is like, Guy, stop it. What the fuck are you doing? And they're like, what the fuck? That's a book. Like, what do you have that for? And Mildred tries to cover for why he has it and says like, oh, once a year, firemen are allowed to take one book home to show them and their families how stupid they are. Like, go ahead, Guy. Like, read us one of those stupid things in the book. You girls are going to love this. Like, it's not going to make any sense. Like, it's Mildred, like that kind of a thing.
Mildred yeah. really coming through right now, though. I didn't expect a lot of her, but I guess also she doesn't want to lose her one TV screen. Yeah. So like, maybe she's really trying hard.
So Guy starts reading a poem to them, and without knowing why, both of the women just uncontrollably are sobbing. And Mildred's like, why are you guys crying? And they're like, I don't know. Like, I gotta go. I don't know what's going on. I need to leave. And they, like, get super pissed at Guy.
He
they're like, well,
read
you fucking
some
ruined
real
it.
Deep human fucking truths to them, and all of a yeah. sudden their bodies shut down.
Yeah. Yeah, so they leave, and Guy's, like, fucking yelling at him, like, ah, get out of here, like, ah, go on, like, whatever. And Mildred runs to the bathroom and starts fucking downing some pills. And while she does that, Guy takes a stack, like a handful of the books he has, and he runs out to the yard and he hides them in the bushes.
Okay, okay.
He then goes to the firehouse, because it's time for his, like, night shift. And he shows Beatty a book. He, like, walks in, he holds up a book. And Beatty's like, ah, and he like even like quotes some fucking prose to Guy Montag as he comes
out. Go dog go to the yeah. tree, to the tree. It's a big yeah, yeah. dog party. I'm aware of this book.
So Guy throws the book in a trash can, lights it on fire, sits down, and the captain's like, so we got it out of our system? And Guy's like, sure.
Just yeah. like you said, here's my one book, and I burned it, and everything's fine.
Yeah. Oh no, did I miss a post-it? I did.
What's the post-it? Go back. You can still tell it to me. The story's fresh in my mind.
So, yes, I did. Okay. So I did. The post-it I wanted to read was also just, it was a part of the conversation between Faber and Guy. So before we continue with the conversation between Beatty and Guy, it's Faber kind of explaining what's important in books and like why Guy like can't quite grasp what's happening. He says, you're a hopeless romantic. It would be funny if it were not serious. It's not books you need. It's some of the things that were once in books. Look forward in nature and look forward in yourself. Books were only one type of receptacle where we stored a lot of things we were afraid we might forget. There is nothing magical in them at all. The magic is only in what the book is only in what books say, how they stitch the patches of the universe together into one garment for us. Of course, you couldn't know this. Of course, you still can't understand what I mean when I say all this. Three things are missing. Number one, do you know why books... such as this are so important, talking about the Bible. They have quality. What does the word quality mean? To me, it means texture. This book has pores. It has features. Detail. Fresh detail. The good writers touch life often. You see why books are hated and feared? They show the pores in the face of life. We are living in a time when flowers are trying to live on flowers instead of growing on good rain and black loam. Even fireworks, for all their prettiness, come from the chemistry of the earth. Yet somehow, we think we can grow feeding on flowers and fireworks without completing the cycle back to reality. Yeah, that's it. That's it, really. It's just a good summation of like why books are important and how they hold ideas.
Right.
Sorry, flash forwarding back now to the firehouse when he sits down with Beatty. As he sits down, they start playing cards. Beatty, after he burns the book, Beatty starts kind of like needling and prying at Guy Montag with literature, like quoting just thing after thing after thing. So I will start that conversation here. So he says, "They are never alone that are accompanied with noble thoughts," we've shouted to ourselves. "Sweet food of sweetly uttered knowledge," Sir Philip Sidney said. "What do you think of that, Montag?" And he's like, "I don't know." And in his ear, Faber is like, "Careful, dude. Like, he's trying to bait you, you know?" And Beatty continues. He's like, "Or this, a little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep, or taste not the Pierian spring. There shallow droughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again. Where does that put you?" And Guy, like, doesn't fucking know what to say.
Yeah, he doesn't know how to comprehend complex ideas. So, like, you quoted Shakespeare at him, or the equivalent of, doesn't mean, he's like, "I don't know."
"Read a few lines and off you go over the cliff. Bang, you're ready to blow up the world, chop off heads, knock down women and children, destroy authority. I know, I've been through it all. I'm not needling, really I'm not. I had a dream an hour ago. I lay down for a catnap, and in this dream, you and I, Montag, got into a furious debate on books. You yelled quotes at me. I calmly parried every thrust. Power, I said, and you, quoting Dr. Johnson, said, knowledge is more than equivalent to force. And I said, well, Dr. Johnson also said, dear boy, that he is no wise man that will quit a certainty for an uncertainty. Stick with the fireman, Montag. All else is dreary chaos." And in the, while this is happening, Faber is still in his ear, like, "Don't listen to him, dude. Like, he's trying to get in your head." And Beatty continues.
But don't let him get in your head. I'm in your head, and I'm telling you, don't let him in. There's only room for one of me.
"And you said," quoting, "truth will come to light, murder will not be hid long." And I cried in good humor, "Oh God, he speaks only of his horse, and the devil can cite scripture for his purpose." And you yelled, "This age thinks better of a gilded fool than a threadbare saint in wisdom's school." And I whispered gently, "The dignity of truth is lost with much protesting." And you shrieked, "Knowledge is power, and a dwarf on a giant's shoulders sees the farthest of the two." And I summed my side up with rare serenity in, "The folly of mistaking a metaphor for proof is inborn in us," Mr. Valery once said. So, like, the thing that's crazy to me is that Beatty is having the entire back-and-forth conversation by himself in front of Guy.
And Beatty just fucking quoted a library's worth of books. Like, what the fuck, Beatty? You're not a good... What's happening?
And he finishes this with, "What traitors' books can be. You think they're backing you up, and they turn on you. Others can use them, too. And there you are, lost in the middle of the moor, in a great welter of nouns and verbs and adjectives." Basically, you read a little bit, and now you think you fucking know everything. Let me fucking sit you down. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of how it goes. So after all of this, an alarm goes off.
Oh, no. Alarm, Beatty. Alarm. The monkey's like, "Ah, ah, ah, you guys gotta go!"
Beatty gets up, gets the printout of, like, the address of where they're supposed to go, kind of smiles to himself, puts it in his pocket, sits back down and is like, "We can wait a second. Let's finish this hand." And Guy is like, "I'm kind of done playing cards." And Beatty's like, "Okay, great. Let's go. Grab your stuff." And so they get in the car. They go to where they're going. And
just the two of them, or is there a squad with them?
The whole squad. Yeah.
Okay.
They get in the truck. They go and they pull up at Guy's house.
Oh, right? No.
Yeah. Mildred comes out and Guy's like, "Yo, did you call in the alarm?" And she, like, cries to herself, starts getting into a cab. And as she's getting in the cab, she's literally just sobbing and saying, "Oh, the poor family." She's sad that the family is going to be burned, essentially. And she's leaving.
But she means she's sad that her family is going to be burned.
Her family meaning the one in the programs.
Oh,
they're gonna burn the wall, and that means the family's
gonna
burn
her fucking wall. Jesus Christ.
Yep.
Okay, so their marriage is over, right? When wife calls the cops on you and gets in a cab, that's when you know, like, oh, okay, absolutely, we're done. Yeah, we're done.
So Beatty goes to Guy and says, "All right, I want you to do this one yourself, and not with kerosene, not the way where we just burn everything. Here's a flamethrower. Go piece by piece and burn every book in your house." And so Guy goes through the house. And he starts flamethrowing everything. And it's pointed out that he can't run for it because the hound is somewhere in the neighborhood kind of patrolling, just waiting for him to try, you know?
Now, mind you, he still has his books in the bushes, though?
Yes.
Okay.
So after he burns all the books in the house and kind of comes back out into the yard, Beatty fucking punches him in the head. And his earpiece flies out.
Oh, no, the two-way seashell!
Mm-hmm. And so Beatty picks it up and, like, puts it into his ear. And Faber is like, "Guy, what's happening? Guy, what's going on?" And so he's like,
"Guy, what's happening over there? Guy, let me know what's happening."
So he's like, "Oh, so you had help. Great. Well, we're going to go ahead and trace this and fucking get whoever this is." And at that moment, Guy, like, kind of points the flamethrower at Beatty. And Beatty is like, "Ah, all right, now we're getting somewhere. Go ahead, fucking do it. Like, I dare..." Basically, like, continually poking him, and he does it. Guy sets him on fire.
Likes being on fire in front of everybody?
Guy burns the captain, and the other two firemen are just like they don't move. They just like are transfixed and watching. So Guy runs over and fucking knocks him out. Like, he hits him in the head because they're like so shocked.
Well, he's breaking their...
This never happens.
Their societal programming. He's going against the Matrix code, mm-hmm. and the other Matrix people don't know what to do with this information.
So he turns around and comes face to face with the Hound.
The robot!
Yes. And the Hound kind of pounces at him and he shoots fire at it, but the Hound jabs him in the leg with one of the syringes. And it's like a numbing agent, like his leg kind of goes dead. But then Guy like kicks it with his other leg and it flies back into the fire and catches on fire and kind of explodes and dies. Okay.
The dog from the fire?
The dog. Yeah. It like got burned and doesn't work anymore.
Got fire right in the CPU. Just whoosh.
Yep. So Guy kind of hobbles over to the bush, finds the books and is like, oh, thank God. Like, Millie didn't know about these ones, and kind of grabs all the books, and takes off. As he does, he kind of thinks to himself, he's like, fuck, I think Beatty wanted to die. Like, Beatty put himself in that situation. Like, he gave Guy the flamethrower and then kept fucking needling him and jabbing at him and pushing him. And even when he had the flamethrower in his face, he like smiled and was like, yeah, fucking do it. So like, Guy is pretty sure that Beatty, with all this knowledge he had, knew what he was doing and finally like wanted out, but needed out in an honorable quote-unquote way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's almost like baptism by fire, right? Mm-hmm. Because now Guy is been awoken like Beatty.
Yeah.
But, okay.
But Guy is taking a different path, whereas Beatty still maintained being a fireman and eventually just made himself die for it. Guy is going the very opposite direction, right? So he runs, and he has a like a regular CCL radio. He hears over the radio that he is now wanted. Like, be on the lookout for a man running through the streets, kind of that thing. Also, he hears that war has been declared.
That Millie's such a bitch. She could have put a she shell in her ear and watched the programs, and he would have had it. Now I know about the shell technology. No,
the programs are only on the walls, though. The seashells is like government news.
Right. Now, is the ATB on him? Yeah. Is it to
where the general public? It's like be on the lookout for someone kind of running through the streets right now. It's nighttime. Be on the lookout for someone running through the streets, male, about this age.
Okay.
If you see him, call him in. He's a fugitive kind of thing. Also, that war has been declared. The U.S. is now at war.
That's what I wanted. That's what I was about to ask you.
Yeah.
Is the war to distract from this firefighter going rogue, or the war is actually?
I think the war is also just happening.
Okay.
It's like kind of a coincidence. So Guy is running through the town and he ends up running to another fireman's house. One of the two, I believe, that he knocked out. And he goes to Steve's house? I can't remember. It is close to that. It is something like that.
Yeah. Okay. It's like Phil or something.
It is. It's like Peter or Steve or something like that.
Okay.
But he sneaks in and he knows that that guy's wife is probably there, like in the house. But he sneaks in, he plants a couple books and he calls in the fucking tip and then he pieces out.
See, if there's multiple robberies all around Gotham, they won't know which robbery to go after.
So he goes to Faber's, and Faber, you know, is like, oh my God, what's going on? I didn't know what was happening. And Guy's like, the shit is going on. I gotta get out of here. Like,
today's the day, buddy. Yeah. Today's the day. We gotta go.
And Faber tells him, like, okay, here's what you need to do. You need to get out of town, head towards the river. I've heard that, like, if you follow the rail lines, the old railroad lines that crisscross the country, there are actually like quote unquote hobo camps of learned, educated, degree holding people who did not want to give into this like version of society and are now living out there just sort of in the, I guess, wilderness, but like, you know, sort of in between cities where no one is, right? And so he's like, okay. He hears over the news that a new hound from another district has been dispatched to hunt down Guy.
But the hounds are also like so technologically advanced. There's only X amount of them, right?
They just like each firehouse has a hound.
Okay.
And they are crazy technologically advanced in that their smell is what they run by. Mm. And they like know your chemical index and exactly what smell you produce then and can fucking pick it up from however far away. Right.
Yeah. They would know you from the smell of weed and Taco Bell.
Hell yeah. guy's like, okay, great. Here's what we got to do. First, we got to clear my scent out of your place completely. So he like burns the chair that he sat on and they like wipe everything down with alcohol and everything. And while they're doing it, he's like, great, give me a suitcase full of your dirtiest clothes. Seal it off with like tape so that it's like airtight. And then also I need a bottle of whiskey because I'm going to need that later.
Just
to get me through this.
This has been a hard day. And he's had happy pills.
My leg hurts like fuck. Yeah.
He's got old fashioned happy water.
So he like runs across the city, and as he's running across the city, like he hears over the news that the news is like, okay, everyone, we need help finding this fugitive named Guy Montag. So now he's being named in the news. We need everyone to go to your window on the count of 10. Open your window and turn on all your outdoor lights. One of you has to see this guy running somewhere. Call it in. And so, like, the news is counting down, like, 10, 9, 8, and guy's, like, fucking sprinting to try to get out of sight of any fucking windows and shit.
What an amazing scene in a book, and also that the mind control over the population, that everybody does this.
Yeah, because it plays out not only over the Seashell Radio, but they also throw it up over all the parlor walls. So everybody knows that they need to do this, and everybody does it. Like, every single person gets up, moves to the window, and waits for the
The billboards that say like drink Coca-Cola right now, it's like Guy Montag wanted. He's running through the city like a fugitive.
Whoosh, so he dives basically right as it hits like one now and all the lights turn on, he like dives into the river. And I think he even like had to cross the highway to get there, and it was super dangerous because cars are fucking flying down, and he even wonders to himself because someone almost hits him, and he's like, he just kind of wonders to himself like, I wonder if that's the same person who killed Clarice, because she apparently got hit by a car, or at least that's what Millie said, right? So he dives into the river, he kind of swims to the other side, he pours the whiskey over him, and then he opens the briefcase, takes off all his clothes, and puts on Faber's dirty clothes to like kind of disguise his own scent. And then he kind of takes off following the rail tracks kind of inland, I guess. As he follows the tracks.
Crazy that he made him smell like a homeless, like a real hobo. Yeah, like drenched in whiskey and BO. Let's do this.
So he finds the rail tracks. He follows them and he finds a campfire with like some people sitting around it. And they know who he is. Like, oh, you must be Guy Montag. And he's like, what the fuck? And they're like, oh, we have a little portable like screen here. We've been watching your fucking escape, you know?
We have a tiny parlor. We have a tiny parlor in a shoebox.
Yeah. One of the guys hands him a flask and is like, drink this. This will change your chemical makeup. In about a half an hour, you're going to smell like two different people. It's
cool.
It's gonna throw off the hound, right?
Future smelly technology.
I literally, after I wrote that in my notes, I put parentheses, future.
Make you smell like a different person. Yeah.
And then they're like, hey, you should watch the screen because in a couple of minutes, they're going to find you and they're going to kill you. And he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? He's like, watch. And they look at the screen and there's almost like a helicopter view of like watching like a traffic chase of the hound running down the street. And there's some fucking random guy just out walking, some pedestrian, and film the hound tackling, injecting, getting the guy, but the guy's face is never shown, and then it cuts to black, and the news goes, great, we got him. Guy Montag apprehended. Another successful capture from the hound. Government
fake,
wins.
Fake news, David. Yep, fake yep, yep, news. Yep. They yep, stage yep. it.
So it turns out all these people at the campfire, these are some of these educated, degree-having, professorial types. They're living out here. They ask Guy, like, what do you have to contribute? And he's like, not much. I mean, like, I know a little bit, I guess, of the book of Ezekiel because that's the one he was trying to. And, like, I had a tiny bit of revelation, but I forget it now. And one of the guys is like, turns to another and he's like, do we have Ezekiel? And that guy is like, oh, yeah, there's a guy in, like, St. Louis, I think, named, like, John or whatever. Who knows it? And he's like, great. Well, Guy, keep that, because if something ever happens to John, you're the book of Ezekiel. And they reveal that like each one of them has some work of literature or the works of a particular author completely memorized. He's like, I'm Chaucer. This guy over here, there's Shakespeare. That's, you know, fucking Descartes or whatever, you know, and they kind of go around. And it turns out there's a network all across the country of these small camps where they all kind of have specialized knowledge of a particular work or a particular thing. They mentioned that there's a small town in like Maryland or something that has 27 people in it. So like no one's ever going to pay attention to that town.
It's only Stephen King novels because it takes place in Maine. One person knows The Shining.
It's the entire like essay collection of, oh fuck, who is it?
Now this is very similar to a movie but it, I can't tell you what movie it is because it will spoil it for you. Because I've talked about it many times that you should watch this movie, but you have not watched this movie.
Oh, no.
But I love that idea. It reminds me of, like, the early stories of the Bible, right? Like, yeah. These oral tales that were memorized because these were nomadic people that didn't write things down. So, like, these stories now have to, like, live inside people's brains.
Yeah. And that town, by the way, I just got it, is the entire essay collection of Bertrand Russell. So anyway, like, that's kind of the system they have. So they kind of welcome guy in, and then, like, they're like, okay, well, we should move a little further away from the city. We're going to keep moving up inland. I mean, war is out. And guy's like, oh, my wife lives in the city. And they're like, ugh, that sucks. The cities are not going to do well in the next couple days. Like, war, you know, like, and then
why is the war going to affect the cities? Because our opponents are going to come over here.
Correct. So literally, like, as I say that, they see bombers fly overhead and they watch in the distance as the city guy was just in is instantly vaporized and flattened.
Whoa. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so they kind of start walking inland and are kind of like, well, at some point in the near future and over the next year or so, there's going to be a lot of people in need. And maybe what we have will serve some use. Maybe not. We'll see.
Is the implication here as well that America is the bad guy and that they're over in England, they still have fucking books?
Yes.
Like, we are...
Yes, they
mentioned
at some point
we have become the Handmaid's Tale! We are the Handmaids, David! Yeah, we fucked up!
Guy at some point, like, thinks to himself about how, like, are we just, like, so involved in our own shit and keeping us so blinded that we have no idea what even is happening with the rest of the world? And essentially, yeah, that's the truth.
So books are only obviously some books are probably lost if you burn all the books in the United States, right? A bunch of shit is lost, but, like, there are still pockets of human truth and knowledge elsewhere. Amazing.
Yeah. And it kind of ends with them sort of walking out and the guy is kind of like, so when they ask us, when people who find us or come into contact with us, when they ask us what we're doing, we can tell them we're remembering. And they kind of walk off into the night, and that is the end of Fahrenheit 451.
Wow.
Yeah.
The end? Okay.
That's the end.
David, you have been heard. I'm processing this. Was there ever a sequel? Was there ever?
No.
Wow.
No.
I will let you know, I bet you someone's going to fucking make this dystopian Them on the Run fucking shit. I don't know when Hollywood's going to get to it. They've tried to remake they try to remake this story all the time, but, like, wow, so he's just, like, on a fugitive on the run in the decay of America, which mm-hmm. is going to happen because of whatever conflict we started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nuts. I love this book.
We'll get to lessons in a second.
Yeah.
What about the story stands out to you so much? Why does it resonate with you? When did you read this? Was this when you started? Did you read this when you were still believing in God? Or
yes, okay. I first read this when I was in high school, and I've read it a few times since. I'm trying to think of what really resonated with me. Part of it, I think, is that sort of, like, how you sort of that level of, like, oh, you sort of woke up, or that veil was sort of slowly pulled away from your eyes by just asking questions. That's sort of my own personal, like, arc that I've had in my life. Like, that's kind of how I sort of moved away from being religious and all that, is, like, oh, I started just asking a bunch of questions, and if I didn't find right answers, then, like, I started to cause more conflict in my mind, and then eventually, you know. So that's probably a part of it. I've always just liked sci-fi in general, so it's a real fun, like, story, and the way it's written is very, like, the pacing is really great. It's Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury is fucking amazing. And I think the dichotomy and relationship between Guy Montag and Beatty really is the driving force for me in why I love this book so much. Mm. Beatty, to me, is one of my favorite villains of all time. He's so complex to me because he is
the
learned
part,
man, but he's on the inside.
Yeah, he's part of the he is the cancer that they are trying to root out.
Mm-hmm.
But
he's using the weapon of that we need to use to break out of it. So, like,
right.
It's like how you're like, oh, the Jedi are dope because they have lightsabers in the Force, and it's like, yeah, but then there's the Sith who are using the same tools for evil, right? And it's like, yeah, that's an interesting dichotomy. But at the same time, he's even more interesting because he knows, like, Beatty knows the actual, like, what the government is doing and why.
Well, it makes me wonder if Beatty had woken up other people. Like, if they're, if you know what I mean.
I get the sense that Beatty hasn't intentionally woken up anyone and would deal harshly with anyone who did, quote unquote, wake up. I think that his like essential suicide by Montag was sort of his final, like, he can't reconcile with himself anymore, like, what he is doing versus what he knows. You know what I mean?
Right, and he protected his family, right? Like, obviously, like, I guess, you know. Yeah. Right, okay. All right, let's go to lessons.
All right.
Lessons.
First lesson that sticks out to me, and I feel like it's very apparent from your reading, don't make fucking robot dogs. They're just... You can't outrun them. They have syringes for teeth. Once we make them, we can't go back. I've seen that Boston Dynamic dog. Get that shit out of here.
I am in total agreement with you on that one.
Listen, we think it's all fun and games till the robot dog turns on you. And it's like, no, bro, you're going down.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, your lessons. Oh, no. David's internet cut out right now. He was having problems earlier.
Just a second.
And we are back. David, the next lesson I want to talk about is don't trust technology.
Dude.
It's going to fail on you. There's nothing we can do about it. You just have to be prepared for it and maybe keep some knowledge in books. That way, when the internet goes down, we still have a society.
The sinking feeling in your heart when you record an hour and 16 minutes and then your computer crashes. Oh, thank God we were able to recover that. Oh, good Lord.
Oh, boy. Okay. My next lesson along with that is we got to build program walls. Let's get these walls into our apartments. Let's do it.
One of my actual lessons I think the story does teach, I think, is think critically. Ask questions. Don't get so complacent in what you're told or the media you consume that you just blindly don't think about anything.
I think when you leave your job, I don't think you need to take the phrase "you're fired" literally. You don't need to like light people on fire, but like to each his own. That's just a lesson I took away from the story.
I actually do have another lesson, and it returns back to Beatty knowing a bunch of literature, which is evil people can be smart, and people with bad agendas or evil intent can use good writings, good statistics to their benefit.
I believe you just told me what Nazis are, right? Like, efficient, lots of lists, typewriters. We know what's going on. Well, yeah. I think there's a lot of lessons from this story.
We're not going to hit all of them.
We're not going to hit them. In fact, we will now put away Fahrenheit 451.
Sounds good.
In preparation for the 100th episode,
David and I
have finally... we're crossing the Rubicon, David. Once we go here, we can never go back. For the 100th episode here on Storytime, David and I are actually going to do Storytime.
Yes, we're going to write our own stories. So I think the idea that we had for this, so since the 100th episode is a special thing, we're right now, each of us are going to give the other person a made-up title of a story. And we have
each given each other a 1 week time frame to finish said story so that this can be released in a timely fashion.
This has to be for our 100th episode, which is the next one. So from today, we'll have 1 week to write a story based on the title given to us by the other. And so our 100th episode will be both of our original stories written by Storytime.
It might be a part one, part two. It might be a part A, part B. I don't know how long your story is going
to
be. You know what I mean?
I don't know either. I mean, that's up to us. We can choose to write a story that would last about a half an episode.
David, I have a title for you.
Bro, I came up with like four. I'm having a hard time picking one to give you, to be honest with you. There's really a toss up between two, and I'm thinking about it. So I want to hear yours first, I think. But
David? Yeah. The story that I am giving you, the title of the story, it mixes in a number of the tales that you have told me.
Okay.
But the story that I would like you to write is entitled Dust and Blood on the Rusty Blades.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Dust and Blood?
Oh, no, not Dustin. Dust and Blood.
Oh, I see.
The Rusty Blades.
Dust and Blood. On the Rusty Blades?
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy. Yikes. Okay. I am glad that you gave me a title in sort of the vein of stories that I've been giving you, because I did the same for you. All of my titles sound like stories that you would have told me on show.
I appreciate you pimping me for success.
Man,
do you want me to vote? Do you want the audience to vote?
Audience voting will take way too long, and you'll have less time to write your story. I'm just going to have to pick one. So I'm going to go with... I would like to hear the story from you, titled The Fox and the Ghost. If we ever do something similar to this, I'm going to save these other ones for later. But I want you to tell me The Fox and the Ghost.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. David, I like where these are going. I like what we have going on here. Well, thank you for sharing with me Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah, man.
I feel like there are parts of that story that I knew. I had no idea that it ended the way that it did. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean like literally like the world continues, but like the mystery is much larger. Like we don't get to see that world get fixed. We just get to see sort of the impetus for change.
More or less, we see the world completely crumble. That's where we leave off. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, this has been episode 99. Next time, two original stories coming out of nowhere for all of you to hear for the first time. Get your butts excited, because we are pretty excited.
Yeah, man.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
Oh, well, boy, indeed.
This has been a wonderful episode of Storytime.
I'm Micah Santel.
I'm David Miller.
And we'll see y'all babies next time.
All right, bye.
Okay, bye.
That's our show, thanks for coming round. Don't be sad, no need to frown. We'll have more stories, don't throw a fit. Goodbye one and all, and we'll see you in a bit.
David, you gotta come back, we have so much to do. David! Okay, all right, everyone, just be cool. Just be cool, everyone. Be cool, Yolanda. I'm still here. I am a host in control. I don't need to worry about David's weird face right now. Okay, I'm going to stop my audio and then get David back on the blower. Everybody be cool. We'll be right back.